Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List. Oh, every time, with the beep straight after the starting of the recording. Excuse me one moment. Do not disturb. Hemingway listeners. I like that. I'm going to keep that. It's nice. Hemingway listeners, welcome back. Today we're talking about Book 6, Chapter 2, Part C. Questions? Zosso was kind of a mean young man. What's with the servant bashing? His choice to let his opponent shoot at him and then ditch his gun seems very unkind to me. It's like saying, you nearly shot to death a man who would not have shot back. This, to me, was almost as bad and cowardly as beating his servant, and he did it because he was scared of being called a coward. Discuss. Somerstars said, the Bible tells stories of men who start off down dark paths, but then change and become saintly. Jesus says many times in the Bible that what is most important is that if the flock strays, they return to the flock. Zosima's story is keeping in this tradition. Good way to look at it. He's a very saintly man, so it makes you feel like he must be harboring a lot of guilt for something if he's going to be doing all this forgiveness seeking. Terrific said, Zosima makes more sense after this vignette. He went from one extreme, the military, to another, the monastery. That sort of extreme switch is so typical of youthful experimentation with identity, and it comes across as true to human nature. He was, per his own account, very impressionable, much like Alyosha, but unlike Alyosha, he came under the influence of the Roughnecks and Wild Cadets. That part about true honour, as opposed to the posturing of the cadets, made me think of Nietzsche again. I have found strength where one does not look for it in simple, mild, and pleasant people without the least desire to rule, and conversely, the desire to rule has often appeared to me in a sign of inward weakness. They fear their own slave soul and shroud it in a royal cloak. In the end, they still become the slaves of their followers, their fame, etc. The powerful natures dominate. It is a necessity. They need not lift one finger, even if during their lifetime they bury themselves in a garden house. Nietzsche, Notebook, Autumn of 1880. I couldn't help but to think of Zosima in his monastery not lifting a finger, yet people seek him out for advice. I think that's why he sent out Alyosha into the world. Zosima is a realist. He recognizes the reality of both the monastic world and the outside world. I guess that's why some of his fellow monks dislike him. He is too connected to the outside, to reality. He also understands and has lived through the painful life outside and has done things he's not proud of. He's no saint, but through acting in his loving, understanding manner, which is genuine, he becomes saint-like in the eyes of others. That will both attract and repel people. Norwegian said, that Nietzsche quote is really apt here. Zosima radiates something genuine. He wants to help people out of active love. People pick up on that. The term virtue signaling has historically been used towards the religious that insist on their own piety. Piety? Piety. Other monks might fast and study to make themselves more holy, but if it's motivated by something like vanity or a quest to simply save themselves or to be better than other people, then they will radiate nothing like what Zosima does. True that. And, yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about, because anyone, I think, who sort of dedicates their life or part of their life to doing good, I think at some point wonders, like, am I doing this for my own image, my own ego, on any level? Interesting thing to contemplate. I am Norwegian said, ha ha ha. I had hoped that SpongeBob picture would get a laugh. It did get a laugh out of me, although I didn't really understand what it meant, but I still found it funny. I tend to forget crucial details sometimes when I write. The Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. He noticed that when people lost hope, they would soon die, and that those that managed to retain hope and a fighting spirit tended to survive much longer. Oh, and there was something in the introduction of Avesi's translation that might help you. Think of Dostoy more as a dramatist, and the dialogue as something you might find in a Shakespeare play, where you'll find the same sort of ranting introspection. Yeah, I suppose That's how I should look at it, like their kind of soliloquies. Yeah. It doesn't come across like a drama play like in Shakespeare. Yeah, anyway. That does help a little bit, though. Thank you. Since I wrote the post about different translations a few days, it has been nagging at me. I bought a third version, this time more expensive, and I finally got a genuine Avsay translation. I read the chapter twice, and the different translation had more impact than I expected from the snippets of comparisons I've seen. Avsay is definitely more modern, and the text flows better. At the same time, I feel as though something is lost in it, or as though the words lack impact in comparison. That might just be me being unused to the style. I think I'll continue reading the Avsay version a while, then switch, reading a shorter chapter in the future twice to figure out which I really prefer. Good idea. Are you looking at two different Avsay translations? Is that what you're saying? Or are you looking at the Garnet one as well? Or a different one? Zosso was kind of a mean young man. What's with the servant bashing? I Am Norwegian said, Alyosha once described his father as not being evil, but rather distorted. I think Alyosha would have been much more accurate saying that to a young Zosima than an old Fyodor. Zosima did something horrible, and it shook him to his core, enough for him to make a permanent change. And regarding whether it was the right thing to do to let the other guy shoot first before ditching his gun and declaring that he was never going to shoot, I thought that was kind of a dick move. But Norwegian said he disagrees. He had to let the other man shoot first to make his point. Zosima himself admits that this is a bizarre and talks later of how we pretend that lies are truth. To me, it's more like saying, I admit that I was a fool and I will suffer the consequences. Yeah, but the reason he said that, he said he had to let the other guy shoot first to make his point, because if he didn't, he would be called a coward. So really the reason he did it that way is because he didn't want to be called a coward. But it's still kind of a mean thing to do to another person, just so you don't have to be called a coward. Which, yeah. I don't know. Because imagine if you were in the other person's shoes, you'd keep yourself up at night thinking, I shot to kill at a person who has no intention of shooting back. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, if someone was as smart as Dostoevsky and alike him, had a great insightful about the inner workings of the human soul and his evil ways, we can say without hesitation that man was philosopher Augustine of Hippo, Saint Augustine. And here in the middle of this family drama and about to happen grim matters, we are introduced to a secondary plot with a style like the Confessions of Saint Augustine. There's a little quote here. I wish to bring back to my mind my past foolishness and the carnal corruption of my soul. This is not because I love them, but because I love you, my lord. The Confessions of Saint Augustine. I feel the insertion of this story fits so well here because both Saint Augustine and Dosto pondered deeply about the same matters. The problem of evil, crime, love, lust, God, and forgiveness. There is not just a cultural reference, but a strong connection between both books. Also, we have the Zosima saint figure-like association, the kind of saint who walks between two worlds. Not to mention the inclusion here of Zosima's story adds tension to the principal plot. Laura Y. Stitch said, okay, I'm continuing to find it hard to believe Zosima's account of things. Everything is so romanticized to the point of unrealistic. Now, like his brother, he's had a revelation and turns religious. All it took was beating his servant in the face. Also, what was up with the servant saying, am I worth it, and crying? That was too much. Great semi-chapter. Too much, you reckon? Yeah, I did think that was a bit, like, weird. Yeah, I do think that would be a bit weird. That scene kind of... It came off to me more like how he would like to remember it rather than what actually happened, right? But it also was like he beat the guy in the face, showed no remorse, and then took up a duel, invitation for a duel, and then had a sinking feeling, and he realized that he felt bad about beating a guy in the face. So he didn't feel bad immediately. It took him like, I don't know, a day, half a day, to even realize that he'd done something bad by smashing his servant's face in twice. And then when he does it, the guy's like, I'm not worthy of like, you forgiving me or you apologizing. I don't know. It was, yeah, it didn't really make sense. It didn't paint him in a very good light, although I think that was sort of the point. All right. That's the conversation about part C. I think now we're going to move on. And let me just see if I've got my thing open. I do. Part D. How long is part D? Oh, it's quite long. That's okay. Oh, it's quite long. Oh dear. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11 pages. Oh dear. That's okay. Let's read 11 pages. Yeah. It's a little bit late at night, but hey, I'll push through. Let's get this done then. Part D is called The Mysterious Visitor. He had long been an official in the town. He was in a prominent position, respected by all, rich, and had a reputation for benevolence. He subscribed considerable sums to the almshouse and the orphan asylum. He was very charitable too, in secret, a fact which only became known after his death. He was a man of about 50, almost stern in appearance, and not quite given to conversation. He had been married about 10 years, and his wife, who was still young, had borne him 3 children. Well, I was sitting alone in my room and the following evening, when my door suddenly opened and this gentleman walked in. I must mention, by the way, that I was no longer living in my former quarters. As soon as I resigned my commission, I took rooms with an old lady, the widow, of a government clerk. My landlady's servant waited upon me, for I had moved into her rooms simply because, on my return from the duel, I had sent a fancy back to the regiment, as I felt ashamed to look him in the face after my last interview with him. So prone is the man of the world to be ashamed of any righteous action. I have, said my visitor, with great interest, listened to you speaking in different houses the last few days, and I wanted at last to make your personal acquaintance, so as to talk to you more intimately. Can you, dear sir, grant me this favour? I can, with the greatest pleasure, and I shall look upon it as an honour. I said this, though I felt more dismayed, so greatly was I impressed from the first moment by the appearance of this man. For, though other people had listened to me with interest and attention, no one had come to me before with such a serious, stern, and concentrated expression. And now he had come to see me in my own rooms. He sat down. You are, I see, a man of great strength and character, he said, as you have dared to serve the truth, even when by doing so you risked incurring the contempt of all. Your praise is... Sorry, I yawned. Your praise is perhaps excessive, I replied. No, it's not excessive, he answered. Believe me, such a course of action is far more difficult than you think. It is that which has impressed me, and it is only on that account that I have come to you, he continued. Tell me, please, that is, if you are not annoyed by my perhaps unseemly curiosity, what were your exact sensations, if you can recall them, at the moment when you made up your mind to ask forgiveness at the duel? Do not think my question frivolous. On the contrary, I have in asking the question a secret motive of my own, which I will perhaps explain to you later on, if it's God's will that we shall become more intimately acquainted. All the while he was speaking, I was looking at him straight into the face, and I felt all at once a complete trust in him and great curiosity on my side also, for I felt that there was some strange secret in his soul. You ask what were my exact sensations at the moment when I asked my opponents for forgiveness, I answered, but I had better tell you from the beginning what I have not yet told anyone else. And I described all that had passed between Afanasy and me, and now, and how I had bowed down to the ground at his feet. From that you can see for yourself, I concluded, that at the time of the duel it was easier for me, for I had made a beginning already at home, and when once I had started on that road to go farther along, it was far from being difficult, but became a source of joy and happiness. I liked the way he looked at me as he listened. All that, he said, is exceedingly interesting. I will come to see you again and again. And from that time forth he came to see me nearly every evening, and we should have become greater friends if only he had ever talked of himself. but about himself he scarcely ever said a word, yet continually asked me about myself. In spite of that, I became very fond of him and spoke with perfect frankness to him about all my feelings, for, thought I, what need have I to know his secrets, since I can see without that that is a good man. Moreover, though he is much as serious and my senior, he comes to see a youngster like me and treats me as his equal, and I learned a great deal that was profitable from him, for he was a man of lofty mind. That life is heaven, he said to me suddenly, that I have long been thinking about. And all at once he added, I think of nothing else indeed. He looked at me and smiled. I am more convinced of it than you are. I will tell you later why. I listened to him and thought that he evidently wanted to tell me something. Heaven, he went on, lies hidden within all of us. Here it lies hidden in me now, and if I will it, it will be revealed to me tomorrow and for all time. I looked at him. He was speaking with great emotion and gazing mysteriously at me, as if he were questioning me, and that we are all responsible to all for all. Apart from our own sins, you are quite right in thinking that, and it is wonderful how you could comprehend it in all its significance at once, and in very truth, so soon as men understand that, the kingdom of heaven will be for them not a dream but a living reality. And when, I cried out to him bitterly, when will that come to pass, and will it ever come to pass? Is it not simply a dream of ours? What then, you don't believe it, he said. You preach it, and you don't believe it yourself. Believe me, this dream, as you call it, will come to pass without doubt. It will come, but not now, for every process has its law. It's a spiritual, psychological process to transform the world, to recreate it afresh. Men must turn into another path psychologically. Until you have become really, in actual fact, a brother to everyone, brotherhood will not come to pass. No sort of scientific teaching, no kind of common interest, will ever teach men to share property and privileges with equal consideration for all. Everyone will think his share too small, and they will be always envying, complaining, and attacking one another. You ask when it will come to pass. It will come to pass, but first, we have to go through the period of isolation. What do you mean by isolation? I asked him. Why, the isolation that prevails everywhere, above all in our age. It is not fully developed. It has not reached its limit yet, for everyone strives to keep his individuality as part as possible, wishes to secure the greatest possible fullness of life for himself, but meantime all his efforts result not in attaining fullness of life but self-destruction, for instead of self-realization he ends by arriving at complete solitude. All mankind in our age have split up into units. They all keep apart, each in his own groove, each one holds aloof, hides himself and hides what he has from the rest, and he ends up being repelled by others and repelling them. He heads up riches by himself and thinks, how strong I am now and how secure. And in his madness he does not understand that the more he heaps up, the more he sinks into self-destructive impotence. For he is accustomed to rely upon himself alone and to cut himself off from the whole. He has trained himself not to believe in the help of others, in men and in humanity, and only trembles for fear he should lose his money and the privilege that he has won for himself. Everywhere in these days men have in their mockery ceased to understand that the true security is to be found in social solidarity rather than in isolated individual effort. But this terrible individualism must inevitably have an end, and all will suddenly understand how unnaturally they are separated from one another. It will be the spirit of the time, and people will marvel that they have sat so long in darkness without seeing the light. And then the signs of the Son of Man will be seen in the heavens. But until then, we must keep the banner flying. Sometimes, even if he has to do it alone, and his conduct seems to be crazy, a man must set an example, and so draw men's souls out of their solitude, and spur them to some act of brotherly love, that the great idea may not die. Our evenings one after another were spent in such stirrings and fervent talk. I gave up society and visited my neighbours much less frequently. Besides, my vogue was somewhat over. I say this not as blame, for they still loved me and treated me good-humouredly, but there's no denying that fashion is a great power in society. I began regarding my mysterious visitor with admiration, for besides enjoying his intelligence, I began to perceive that he was brooding over some plan in his heart, and was preparing himself perhaps for a great deed. Perhaps he liked my not showing his curiosity about his secret, not seeking to discover it by direct question or by insinuation, but I noticed at last that he seemed to show signs of wanting to tell me something. This had become quite evident, indeed, about a month after his first visit. "Do you know," he said to me at once, "that people are very inquisitive about us in the town and wonder why I come to see you so often, but let them wonder, for soon all will be explained." Sometimes an extraordinary agitation would come over him, and almost always on such occasions he would get up and go away. Sometimes he would fix a long piercing look at me, and I thought he will say something directly now, but he would suddenly begin talking of something ordinary and familiar. He often complained of headaches too. One day, quite unexpectedly indeed, after he had been talking with great fervour a long time, I saw him suddenly turn pale and his face worked convulsively while he stared persistently at me. "What's the matter?" I said. "Do you feel ill?" He had just been complaining of a headache. I murdered someone." He said this and smiled with a face as white as chalk. "Why is it he is smiling?" The thought flashed through my mind before I realised anything else. I too turned pale. "What are you saying?" I cried. "You see," he said, with a pale smile, "how much it has cost me to say the first word. Now I have said it, I feel I've taken the first step and shall go on." For a while I could not believe him, and I did not believe him at that time, but only after he had been to see me 3 days running and told me all about it, I thought he was mad, but ended by being convinced, to my great grief and amazement. His crime was a great and terrible one. 14 years before, he had murdered the widow of a landowner, a wealthy and handsome young woman, who had a house in our town. He fell passionately in love with her, declared his feeling, and tried to persuade her to marry him, but she had already given her heart to another man, an officer of noble birth and high rank in the service, who was at that time away at the front, though she was expecting him to soon return. She refused his offer and begged him not to come and see her. After he had ceased to visit her, he took advantage of his knowledge of the house to enter at night through the garden by the roof, at great risk of discovery. But, as often happens, a crime committed with extraordinary audacity is more successful than others. Entering the garret through the skylight, he went down the ladder, knowing that the door at the bottom of it was sometimes, through negligence of the servants, left unlocked. He hoped to find it so, and so it was. He made his way in the dark to her bedroom, where a light was burning, as though on purpose. Both her maids had gone off to a birthday party on the same street, without asking leave. The other servants slept in the servants' quarters or in the kitchen on the ground floor. His passion flamed up at the sight of her asleep, and then vindictive, jealous anger took possession of his heart, and like a drunken man beside himself, he thrust a knife into her heart so that she did not even cry out. Then, with devilish and criminal cunning, he contrived that suspicion should fall on the servants. He was so base as to take her purse, to open her chest with keys from under her pillow, and to take some things from it, doing it all as it might have been done by an ignorant servant, leaving valuable papers and taking only money. He took some of the larger gold things, but left smaller articles that were 10 times as valuable. He took with him, too, some things for himself as remembrances, but of that later. Having done this awful deed, he returned by the way he had come. Neither the next day, when the alarm was raised, nor at any time after in his life, did anyone dream of suspecting that he was the criminal. No one indeed knew of his love for her, for he was always reserved and silent, and had no friend to whom he would have opened his heart. He was looked upon simply as an acquaintance, and not a very intimate one, of the murdered woman. As for the previous fortnight, he had not even visited her. A serf of hers called Peter was at once suspected, and every circumstance confirmed the suspicion. The man knew, indeed, his mistress did not conceal the fact that, having to send one of her serfs as a recruit, she had decided to send him, as he had no relations of his conduct, and his conduct was unsatisfactory. People had heard him angrily threatening to murder her when he was drunk in a tavern. 2 days before her death, he had run away, staying no one knew where in the town. The day after the murder, he was found on the road leading out of town, dead drunk, with a knife in his pocket, and his right hand happened to be stained with blood. He He declared that his nose had been bleeding, but no one believed him. The maids confessed that he had gone to a party and that the street door had been left open till they returned. And a number of similar details came to light, throwing suspicion on the innocent servant. They arrested him and he was tried for the murder, but a week after the arrest, the prisoner fell sick of a fever and died unconscious in the hospital. There the matter ended, and the judges and the authorities and everyone in the town remained convinced that the crime had been committed by no one but the servant who had died in the hospital, and after the punishment began. My mysterious visitor, now my friend, told me that at first he was not in the least troubled by pangs of conscience. He was miserable a long time, but not for that reason, only from regret that he had killed the woman he loved. Not that she was no more, that in killing her he had killed his love, while the fire of passion was still in his veins. But of the innocent blood he had shed, of the murder of the fellow creature, he scarcely thought. The thought of his victim might have become the wife of another man was insupportable to him, and so for a long time he was convinced in his conscience that he could not have acted otherwise. At first he was worried at the arrest of the servant, but his illness and death soon set his mind at rest, for the man's death was apparently, so he reflected at the time, not owing to his arrest and his fright, but a chill he had taken on the day he ran away, when he had lain all night drunk, dead drunk, on the damp ground. The theft of the money and other things troubled him little, for he argued that the theft had not been committed for gain, but to avert suspicion. The sum stolen was small, and he shortly afterwards subscribed the whole of it, and much more, towards the fund for maintaining an almshouse in the town. He did this on purpose to set his conscience at rest about the theft, and it's a remarkable fact that for a long time he really was at peace. He told me this himself. He entered then upon a career of great activity in the service, volunteered for a difficult and laborious duty which occupied him 2 years, and being a man of strong will, almost forgot the past. Whenever he recalled it, he tried not to think of it at all. He became actively in philanthropy too, founded and helped to maintain many institutions in the town, did a great deal in the two capitals, in both Moscow and Petersburg, was elected a member of philanthropic societies. At last, however, he began brooding over the past, and the strain of it was too much for him. Then he was attracted by a fine and intelligent girl, and soon after married her, hoping that marriage would dispel his lonely depression, and that by entering on a new life and scrupulously doing his duty to his wife and children, he would escape from old memories altogether. But the very opposite of what he expected happened. He began, even in the first month of his marriage, to be continually fretted by the thought, "My wife loves me, but what if she knew?" When she first told him that she would soon bear him a child, he was troubled. "I am giving life, but I have taken life. Children came. How dare I love them and teach them and educate them? How can I talk to them of virtue? I have shed blood." They were splendid children. He longed to caress them. "And I can't look at their innocent, candid faces. I am unworthy." At last he began to bitterly and ominously be haunted by the blood of his murdered victims, by the young life he had destroyed, by the blood that cried out for vengeance. He had begun to have awful dreams, but being a man of fortitude, he bore this suffering a long time, thinking, "I shall expiate everything to this secret agony." But that hope, too, was vain. The longer it went on, the more intense was his suffering. He was respected in society for his active benevolence, though everyone was overawed by his stern and gloomy character. But the more he was respected, the more intolerable it was for him. He confessed to me that he had thoughts of killing himself, but he began to be haunted by another idea, an idea which he had at first regarded as simply unthinkable, though at last it got a hold on his heart that he could not shake it off. He dreamed of rising up, going out and confessing in the face of all men that he had committed murder. For 3 years this dream had pursued him, haunting him in different forms. At last he believed with his whole heart that if he confessed his crime, he would heal his soul and would be at peace forever. But this belief filled his heart with terror, for how could he carry it? And then came what happened at my duel. Looking at him, I have made up my mind. I looked at him. Is it possible, I cried, clasping my hand, that such a trivial incident could give rise to a resolution for you? My resolution has been growing for the last 3 years, he answered, and your story only gave the last touch to it. Looking at you, I reproached myself and envied you. He said this to me almost sullenly. But you won't be believed, I observed. It's 14 years ago. I have proofs, great proofs. I shall show them. Then I cried and kissed him. Tell me one thing, he said, as though it all depended upon me. My wife, my children, my wife may die of grief, and though my children won't lose their rank and property, they'll be convicts' children, and forever. And what a memory of me I shall leave in their hearts. I said nothing. And to part from them, to leave them forever, it's forever, you know, forever. I sat still and repeated a silent prayer. I got up at last. I felt afraid. Well, he looked at me. Go, I said. Confess, everything passes, only the truth remains. Your children will understand when they grow up the nobility of your resolution. He left me that time as though he had made up his mind, yet for more than a fortnight afterwards he came to me every evening, still preparing himself, still unable to bring himself to the point. He made my heart ache. One day he would come determined and say fervently, I know it will be heaven for me, heaven, the moment I confess. 14 years I've been in hell. I want to suffer. I will take my punishment and begin to live. You can pass through the world doing wrong, but there's no turning back. Now I dare not love my neighbour, nor even my own children. Good God, my children will understand, perhaps, but what my punishment has cost me and will not condemn me. God is not in strength, but in truth. All will understand your sacrifice, I said to him. If not at once, they will understand it later, for you have served truth, the higher truth, not of the earth. And he would go away seeming comforted, but next day he would come again bitter, pale, and sarcastic. Every time I come to you, you look at me with so inquisitively, as though to say, he has still not confessed. Wait a bit, don't despise me too much. It's not such an easy thing to do as you would think. Perhaps I shall not do it at all. You won't go and inform against me then, will you? And far from looking at him with indiscreet curiosity, I was afraid to look at him at all. I was quite ill from anxiety, and my heart was full of tears. I could not sleep at night. I have just come from my wife, he went on. Do you understand what the word wife means? When I went out, the children called to me, Goodbye, father. Make haste back to read the children's magazines with us. No, you don't understand that. No one is wise from another man's woes. His eyes were glittering, his lips were twitching. Suddenly he struck the table with his fist so that everything on it danced. It was the first time he had done such a thing. He was such a mild man. But need I, he exclaimed, must I? No one has been condemned. No one has been sent to Siberia in my place. The man died of fever, and I've been punished by my sufferings for the blood I shed, and I shan't be believed. They won't believe my proofs. Need I confess, need I? I am ready to go on suffering all my life for the blood I have shed. If only my wife and children may be spared, will it be just to ruin them with me? Just? Will it be just to ruin them with me? Aren't we making a mistake? What is right in this case? And will people recognize it? Will they appreciate it? Will they respect it? Good Lord, I thought to myself, he is thinking of other people's respect at such a moment. And I felt so sorry for him then that I believe I would have shared his fate if it could have comforted him. I saw he was beside himself. I was aghast, realizing with my heart, as well as my mind, what such a resolution meant. Decide my fate, he exclaimed again. Go and confess, I whispered to him. My voice failed me, but I whispered it firmly. I took up the New Testament from the table, the Russian translation, and vowed and showed him the Gospel of St. John, chapter 12, verse 24. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. I had just been reading that verse when he came in. He read it. That's true, he said. He smiled bitterly. It's terrible, the things you find in those books, he said, after a pause. It's easy enough to thrust them upon one. And who wrote them? Can they have been written by men? The Holy Spirit wrote them, said I. It's easy for you to prate. He smiled again, this time almost with hatred. I took the book again, opened it in another place, and showed him the Epistle of the Hebrews, chapter 10, verse 31. He read, It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. He read it and simply flung down the book. He was trembling all over. An awful text, he said. There's no denying you've picked out fitting ones. He rose from the chair. Well, he said, goodbye, perhaps I shan't come again. we shall meet in heaven. So I have been for 14 years in the hands of the living God. That's how one must think of those 14 years. Tomorrow I will beseech those hands to let me go. I wanted to take him into my arms and kiss him, but I did not dare. His face was contorted ad somber. He went away. Good God, I thought. What has he gone to face? I fell on my knees before the icon and wept for him before the Holy Mother of God, our swift defender and helper. I was half an hour praying in tears, and it was late, about midnight. Suddenly I saw the door open, and he came in again. I was surprised. Where have you been? I asked him. I think, he said, I've forgotten something, my handkerchief. I think, well, even if I've not forgotten anything, let me stay a little. He sat down. I stood over him. You sit down too, he said. I sat down. We sat still for 2 minutes. He looked intently at me and suddenly smiled. I remembered that. Then he got up, embraced me and warmly and kissed me. Remember, he said, how I came to you a second time. Do you hear? Remember it. And he went out. Tomorrow, I thought. And so it was. I did not know that evening that the next day was his birthday. I had been out for the last few days, so had no chance of hearing it from anyone. On that day, he always had a great gathering. Everyone in the town went in. It was the same this time. After dinner, he walked into the middle of the room with a paper in his hand, a formal declaration to the chief of his department, who was present. This declaration he read aloud to the whole assembly. It contained a full account of the crime in every detail. I cut myself off from men as a monster. God has visited me, he said in conclusion. I want to suffer for my sin. Then he brought out and laid on the table all the things he had been keeping for 14 years that he thought would prove his crime, the jewels belonging to the murdered woman, which he had stolen to divert suspicion, a cross and a locket taken from her neck, with a portrait of her betrothed in the locket, her notebook and 2 letters, one from her betrothed telling her that he would soon be with her, and her unfinished answer left on the table to be sent off next day. He carried off these 2 letters. What for? Why had he kept them for 14 years afterwards instead of destroying them as evidence against him? And this is what happened. Everyone was amazed and horrified. Everyone refused to believe it and thought he was deranged, though all listening with intense curiosity. A few days later, it was fully decided and agreed in every house that the unhappy man was mad. The legal authorities could not refuse to take the case up, but they too dropped it. Though the trinkets and letters made them ponder, they decided that even if they did turn out to be authentic, no charge could be based on those alone. Besides, he might have given him those things as a friend, or asked him to take care of them for her. I heard afterwards, however, that the genuineness of the things was proved by friends and relations of the murdered woman, and that there was no doubt about them. Yet nothing was destined to come of it, after all. 5 days later, all he had heard was he was ill, and that his life was in danger. The nature of his illness I can't explain. They said it was an affection of the heart. But it became known that the doctors had been induced by his wife to investigate his mental condition also, and had come to the conclusion that it was a case of insanity. I betrayed nothing, though people ran to question me. But when I wanted to visit him, I was for a long while forbidden to do so, above all by his own wife. It's you who have caused his illness, she said to me. He was always gloomy, but for the last year people noticed that he was peculiarly excited and strange, did strange things, and now you have been the ruin of him. Your preaching has brought him to this. For the last month he was always with you. Indeed, not only his wife but the whole town were down upon me and blamed me. It's all your doing, they said. I was silent and indeed rejoiced at heart, for I saw plainly God's mercy to the man who had turned against himself and punished himself. I could not believe in his insanity. They let me see him at last. He insisted upon saying goodbye to me. I went in to him and saw at once that not only his days but his hours were numbered. He was weak and yellow. His hands trembled. He gasped for breath, but his face was full and tender and feeling happy. It is done, he said. I have long been yearning to see you. Why didn't you come? I did not tell him that they would not let me see him. God has had pity on me and is calling me to himself. I know I am dying, but I feel joy and peace for the first time after so many years. There was heaven in my heart from my child, from my moment. I had done what I had to do. Now I dare to love my children and to kiss them. Neither my wife nor the judges nor anyone has believed it. My children will never believe it either. I see in that God's mercy to them. I shall die and my name will be without a stain for them. And now I feel God near. My heart rejoices as in heaven. I have done my duty. He could not speak. He gasped for breath. He pressed my hand warmly, looking fervently at me. We did not talk for so long. His wife kept peeping at us. But he had time to whisper to me, "Do you remember how I came back to you that second time at midnight? I told you, remember it. You know what I came back for? I came to kill you." I started. I went out from you then into the darkness. I wandered about the streets, struggling with myself, and suddenly I hated you so that I could hardly bear it. Now I thought, he is all that binds me, and he is my judge. I can't refuse to face my punishment tomorrow, for he knows all. It was not that I was afraid you would betray me, I never even thought of that, but I thought, how can I look him in the face if I don't confess? And if you had been at the other end of the earth, but alive, it would have been all the same. The thought was unendurable, that you were alive, knowing everything and condemning me. I hated you as though you were the cause, as though you were to blame for everything. I came back to you then, remembering that you had a dagger lying on your table. I sat down and asked you to sit down, and for a whole minute I pondered. If I had killed you, I should have been ruined by that murder, even if I had not confessed the other. But I didn't think about that at all, and I didn't want to think of it at that moment. I only hated you and longed to revenge myself on you for everything. The Lord vanquished the devil in my heart, but let me tell you, you were never nearer death. You were never nearer death. A week later he died. The whole town followed him to the grave. The chief priests made a speech full of feeling. All lamented the terrible illness that had cut short his days, but all the town was up in arms against me after the funeral, and people even refused to see me. Some at first, a few, and afterwards more, began indeed to believe in the truth of his story, and they visited me and questioned me with great interest and eagerness. For man loves to see the downfall and disgrace of the righteous, but I held my tongue very shortly after I left the town, and 5 months later, by God's grace, I entered the safe and blessed path, praising the unseen finger which had guided me so clearly to it. But I remember in my prayer to this day the servant of God, Mihail, who suffered so greatly. All right, there we go. That was part D. Nice little story. Have your say about it at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist, and I will see you tomorrow.